doors and open.
Evaluate mergers and should they be
most organizations, we have a big part that does our operational support, HR, finance, IT, and security, and a big and a significant and important part of running an organization like the Commission is to ensure good governance according to the PFMA, Treasury regulations, and other legislation. What I'm going to do is, you know, typically the way you look at the way in which our annual report is designed, typically people look at the different sections in the organization and report of what the different departments are doing. We've done that, but I think to cut to the chase, we felt that a more important thing to do is to look at our priority sectors and in those priority sectors see what work we've done and what's been happening in those sectors and in those markets. And we've designed our annual report like that, so you get a bigger picture of, you know, the kind of content of our work rather than the detail of what each division is doing. So I'll go to that first, and then we'll kind of then take it division by division in the competition in the organization itself and see what they do. So you'd all be aware that one of our big priority sectors was food and agro-processing. This goes to the high costs of food for our people, and the Competition Commission felt had a big role to play in bringing those prices down. We've had a number of cases in this area, and in the period under review, very significantly, there was a penalty levied on Pioneer, which is one of the four bread companies, bread and milling companies we've been prosecuting over the past 3 years. This was the last of those companies. You recall that the other one of those four companies got leniency from us and was not prosecuted. The other two settled with us, so we reached a settlement, and this company opted to pursue the case, claim innocence and defend the allegations, and they did so before the tribunal, and we won the case, and the tribunal levied a penalty of 195 million on this company for collusion in just the bread part of their business. This decision underwent an appeal, both from our side and the Pioneer side. We felt that the way in which the fine was calculated was incorrect. We thought they should have used the turnover of the total of the big parent company rather than just that part of the business dealing with bread. And we wanted to appeal that so that we could kind of set precedent for our future fines to be based on a higher turnover. And they also counter-appealed the case. But what's happened since that is we've had a number of different cases against Pioneer, not only in bread, but in other markets in the milling industry, most importantly, which is part of the bread value chain. And they were very keen. They got a big shock when this fine hit them. They began to take it really seriously, and they began negotiating with us to settle the remaining cases, and we began the settlement negotiations with them, which we will soon conclude. And on the basis of that, we both withdrew our appeal before the Competition Appeal Court. So that appeal is not going to go ahead in the same way that we thought it would, although there was a hearing before the Competition Appeal Court to explain to the court what it is that we were doing. And that's one of the bigger kind of dramatic things that happened in the year under review. In another case also involving milling, one of the members of the milling cartel negotiated a consent agreement with us and agreed to pay 6.7 million rand for their participation in the milling cartel. And our case against the remaining members of that cartel is currently continuing. The other very big issue that occurred, a very big fine that occurred in this period, was against Sasol Chemical Industries, a penalty of 250 odd million rand for collusion in the fertilizer market. This was also as a consequence of a consent agreement. In other words, they reached agreement with us, and this was ratified by the Competition Tribunal. The other two members of that cartel firms, they're called Omnia and Yara, are defending the case. In other words, they're not, you know, they're not, they're in you'll find that this now is like a little general trend that I'll talk about all the time, where we win cases and just about to proceed on cases, and there's all these legal points that are getting drawn into kind of delay cases and kind of frustrate kind of quick resolution of these cases. So that's in food and agro-processing. The other big area is infrastructure and construction. The point's been made often enough here that collusive tendering by construction companies increases the cost of government investment in new and improved infrastructure. And this is a big part of government spending. It's a big, it's a pivotal part of our industrial policy, and costs to government are going to be considerably higher because of collusive practices, both in terms of the inputs to construction, which is cement, bricks, and the products that are used in construction, as well as in the and cement, as well as in project management and the companies that get the bids to actually build the roads or the stadiums or whatever it is. We've got investigations, a number of investigations into the product markets, products that go into construction, a raid that we conducted in the cement industry in the period under review was kind of successful in the sense that immediately after the raid, one of the parties that we raided came to us and sought leniency. Said, look, you know, we admit and we want to negotiate a settlement with you. And in the period under review, we've referred and settled a number of cases specifically on cast concrete, plastic pipes, bitumen, reinforced steel. Then, in terms of intermediate industrial products, now these, you recall, these are the products that go into manufacturing, and the pricing practices in these markets. You know, essentially here we're talking about things like steel and chemicals and plastics that go into the manufacturing sector in order to make more value-added products. The high costs of these inputs and the way in which they're priced impacts on the ability and competitiveness of the downstream industries, and the downstream industries are what are the kind of critical part of our industrial policy and employment-seeking strategies, because that's where you create employment. The manufacturing sector is where employment is created, and if that sector is not incentivized to grow. In other words, if input costs are too high, you're just kind of not developing the very sector that's going to be absorbing lots of employment. And that's the big kind of developmental challenge, as we're all aware, that we've got to address. So the focus here has been on steel and polymers. There's been four cartel cases, mostly in the steel and steel-related industries, that we've referred to the tribunal for adjudication. When I say that, I mean we've completed our investigation and we're now going to prosecute these the parties concerned. And this is in the manufacturing and supply of long steel products, the supply of wire and wire products, supply of mining roof bolts, and supply of reinforcing wire mesh. Okay? You'll see that in some of these, they kind of overlap with the food producing sectors as well, because things like wire mesh, you know, used in agriculture for building fences, chicken coops, and whatever. And then the third part, the final part here is our work on financial services and banking. And here you recall that. This is a sector that has its own regulators. Financial sector is regulated under the auspices of National Treasury. It has a number of different regulators that report to it. The South African Reserve Bank is responsible for regulating the banking sector in particular, and it's always difficult for a competition authority. be interacting, to be up, to be taking action in a sector that is regulated by another regulator, because then there's questions of jurisdiction, whose responsibility it is to do what the respective roles and jurisdiction of the respective regulators are. And we opted at the time to kind of have a very open public process involving all the stakeholders, getting a discussion going on what the big major policy issues in this sector are. Of course, our angle in was that, insofar as we were concerned, that the problem that related directly to our responsibility, our jurisdiction, were high, the high cost of bank charges, the high bank charges, which there was a lot of public opinion about. But you can't deal with that in isolation. You need to look at how the whole sector is regulated. And the public process that we were involved in got the banks involved and thinking through the issues that we put on the table, as it did with National Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank. And what came out of that is a very complicated technical report on what's going on in the sector, and the inquiry came up with 28 recommendations. Those recommendations were not recommendations all directed at us as the Competition Commission. In other words, they weren't asking the question, what can the Competition Commission do? They were asking the question, what is wrong with the sector? What are the competition problems in the sector, and what can be done about it? And if you answer the latter question, some of what can be done about these things is not necessarily things that the Competition Commission has the authority to do. A lot of these changes need to be implemented by the regulator of the banking sector itself. And so a lot of the, if you looked at them in total, the 28 recommendations, there were things that the Competition Commission could do, very few. Most of it were what the banks themselves needed to do in order to become more consumer friendly, and what the regulatory regime, how the regulatory regime needed to be changed in order to create more competitive outcomes. And given that, what we had to do, this is what we call our advocacy work, right? Just to kind of give you a concrete example of it. It's not some where we take a case up against somebody. It's where we're trying to gently, through moral suasion, to kind of making good arguments, to having public participation, get other parts of government to kind of take into account competition issues in the way in which they regulate a specific sector. So we set up a steering committee comprising of ourselves, the DTI, Treasury, and the South African Reserve Bank to go through all of these recommendations and see how we give effect to them. And just this year, in fact, the current year, not the last year, we've had announcements, and I mean, you know, our inputs here, our outputs were discussion papers, which we've listed in the slide. But just to bring you up to date, is that the Minister of Finance is now beginning to give effect to these regulations, and even just yesterday's newspaper reported on the possibilities of setting up independent regulators to regulate the banking. A lot of that work that is now being picked up by National Treasury and the Reserve Bank arises out of the more detailed thinking and the consultation and the public debates that occurred in our banking inquiry process. Okay. So now I'm going to look at the kind of different areas of our work. This is kind of pretty much corresponds with what the different divisions are doing. And you'll recall that the three main areas are enforcement, which is the legal cases we take up, investigate and take up. The second part is mergers, and the third part is advocacy. So in the first part, the enforcement cases, this is a slide that essentially shows over a three-year period, for 3 years, for the last 3 years, the last the green part is the current year, the year not current year, 2009-10. And the others, it's just giving you a comparison from where we're coming from over the last 2 years. You'll see that essentially the number of complaints we are receiving is steadily increasing. We're getting more and more complaints. In the first graph, you'll see that we carry over from 1 year to the next. In other words, we're not completing. Investigations don't take a varied amount of time, and more complicated investigations can take a pretty long time. We're getting more complaints from the public, and then the commission is increasingly initiating its own complaints based on the information we have from all different sources. In other words, we don't only respond to complaints from the public, we kind of work out ourselves where the big issues or big problems might be, and we ourselves initiate cases in those instances. Then, if you look at the types of cases that we've initiated and classify them by sector, you'll see how the Commission has, in fact, been concentrating on its priority sectors. Most of these cases are in the three priority sectors that I've mentioned earlier. However, this does not by any means, mean that we don't take on cases outside the sectors we've classified as priority. There are, as far as the cases there, we kind of proceed with those as well. Now, as we reported previously to this committee, one of the things clearly that's led to some of our more recent successes is the way we've begun to use our corporate leniency program. This came into being in about 2006, I think, 5 or 6. Revamped it in 2008, and this is a policy where the first firm, which is a member of a cartel, that comes to us and gives us information that leads to a successful prosecution, or information that we didn't previously have about the way in which a cartel operates, will get leniency, which means that they will get indemnity from being prosecuted. We'll prosecute the remaining members of the cartel, not the firm that is working with us. And we've seen very, very significant and dramatic increases in corporate leniency applications in the year under review. I mean, that was the year where we had, we went from 13 to 79. This is a very dramatic increase in the number of corporate leniency applications we've got. Corporate leniency applications, kind of needless to say, is something that enables us to very successfully prosecute a case, because if it's one member of the cartel tells on the remaining members, it just becomes easier for us in terms of the evidence to kind of successfully prosecute a case. So what we've seen in the year under review and continuing now is much higher levels of litigation that this organization is doing. We are in the courts much more than we previously were. Okay? This is a big point, because this is a point that has all kinds of organizational implications. For example, if you're in the courts more often, you need to increase your lawyering capacity. Within the organization, you need to hire more external lawyers, you need more senior counsel, who are the only people who can appear in the higher courts, in the Supreme Court and the High Courts. And this slide essentially gives you the numbers of cases where litigation was involved. In other words, lawyers had to get involved in kind of number of cases, and this is a nice slide because it shows these cases right from the beginning of the organization. You see, and the different colors here tell you the different sections of the act that are used in prosecuting the cases. And you know that, you know, essentially there's two broad categories. The one category is, relates to collusive conduct, and the other relates to abuse of dominant conduct. In other words, we're a dominant firm that owns the most of the market, over 45%, say, are kind of creating problems for other players in the market that are anti-competitive in some way. And you'll see that the most dramatic increases has been in what is orange on that screen, which is your 4.1b, which relates to collusion, which are collusion cases. So most of the cases that we're getting, most of the complaints that we're referring to prosecution relate to collusion conduct. Then just a summary of, and I've been through some of this when I look at the priority sector, just the summary of the penalties that we have collected in the period under review. The penalties amounted to 487.2 million. Okay. Most of these penalties, well, with the exception of Pioneer, the remaining of these, Pioneer, the bread of the 195 million, which was something that the that occurred after a case and the tribunal decided after the case, the remaining penalties were negotiated as settlements with the parties. We didn't go to court and fight it out in court, except for the Pioneer case. That says a number of things, I think. I mean, it says that increasingly the kind of success that respondents in our cases are not seeing our cases as empty threats that they can kind of take their chances with in the courts. You know, they kind of, in other words, we as an institution are a credible threat to them. They would rather come and settle with us, even if it's for 250 million rand, than take their chances in courts. In these instances, although my earlier point is that there are still a lot of companies that feel they want to take their chances in court, and that's where all the kind of legal wranglings come in, which I spoke about earlier. But I think that it's encouraging that some big companies like Sasol are saying, look, let's rather settle than kind of continue with kind of legal points to be made in court. And I think, I can't resist but point out that the 487 million rand that we've collected in penalties is if you compare it with, if that's the money, in other words, that has gone straight to the National Revenue Fund, this money is not money that comes to us, it goes to the fiscus. That 487 million rand, you could compare it with our budget later on, which was 128 million rand, which we spent, and our government grant we got was 80 million rand. So we put 487 million rand into the fiscus, and we took 80 million rand out of it. Okay, so we kind of, in business terms, we are a net profit-making organization. Now, the other big area of our work is mergers. This is a significant thing now, insofar as in the previous year, in the year prior to the year under review, what we did is we raised thresholds for mandatory notification. Okay, so the Competition Act says that mergers above a certain threshold, which is worked out on the basis of annual turnover and asset value has to be notified to the competition authority and has to be approved before those mergers can proceed. And we set some figures of those thresholds when the Act came into being, and for seven odd years we had stuck to those thresholds, and as the value of money decreased, the numbers of mergers we began giving kind of steadily increased over time. And we had to kind of adjust it. So we kind of raised the threshold, which meant we had fewer mergers being notified to us. And this reflects that. So you'll see there's been a kind of decline in the number of kind of mergers that got notified to us. There's a number of implications for that. Firstly, our filing fee for mergers, which is part of our income, dropped. Okay, and that meant we needed a higher a proportion of our budget to be contributed by a government transfer than previously. Okay, we also incidentally raised the filing fee, but the net effect of it was the quantum amount dropped, the total amount that we received. I think very, this probably is made better in the next slide, the point is that there were kind of concerns that once you raise the threshold for compulsory notification, you might lose some of those important mergers that previously would have been caught in the regulatory net, but now you no longer will catch them. And so we put into place mechanisms to ensure that even those mergers that do not require compulsory notification, we can ask for them to be notified, which is something the Competition Act allows us to do. We can ask for them to be notified, and we put out a practice note, indicating to the lawyer community in particular, but industry generally, on what kinds of issues we will be looking at in order to call for a merger to be notified that is not statutorily required to be notified any longer. And basically there we've said that in all industries where we are investigating anti-competitive conduct, in our priority industries, in our priority sectors, basically, even if a merger is small and doesn't meet the threshold for compulsory notification, we will, the chances are is we would want to look at them, because our enforcement work, our investigative work is telling us that there are problems in those sectors. But also, if you look at what the outcome of merger reviews are, this might be a difficult slide to look at because it's left to right rather than up to down. You'll see that, I mean, the numbers of the cases finalized is simple enough. But what you'll see is that the vast majority of cases that come to us, we approve without a problem. So in the period under review, 190 of the 208 cases were approved without any problem. We only prohibited one case, and we approved with conditions 8 cases in that period. And it was that kind of data that told us, look, let's not kind of be, let's kind of cut down on the number of mergers we are looking at, considering the low number that poses problems. And of course, businesses are very keen to argue that you don't want kind of very onerous requirements of them in terms of regulations, because that goes to the costs of doing business. So that was one of the kind of reasoning behind raising the thresholds. But this basically looks at the outcome of our merger reviews for the year, and it's kind of consistent with our previous years, and it's absolutely consistent with other jurisdictions as well. So in other jurisdictions, you'll find the same proportions of problematic mergers versus unproblematic mergers. Okay, so just to summarize, we had fewer merger notifications. Interestingly, about 8% of them claimed financial distress, in other words, used the processes were taking place. One of the things we look at very closely in merger reviews is the number of jobs that were lost, and in 19 transactions, huge numbers of jobs lost, a total of 2,000. In some instances, we've imposed conditions on the mergers to put a ceiling to the number of jobs that get lost. So in other words, we'll say, you know, we approve this merger provided you do not dismiss more than a particular number of employees. That's the maximum number. There was one merger where we recommended a prohibition. This was a merger between Massmart and Finro. Massmart is a wholesale company in it sells wholesale to the it used to sell wholesale to supermarkets and small shops, but more recently has had a strategy of entering into the retail sector as well. In other words, in direct competition with your Pick and Pay and Checkers, and it was buying off a whole lot of smaller supermarkets, particularly in rural areas. And we recommended prohibition of this particular merger with Finro, but our arguments didn't gain muster in the tribunal because further evidence was provided in the tribunal hearing, and the tribunal decided to approve that merger. The other very significant thing that happened in terms of conditions is in a merger between two pharmaceutical companies. GlaxoSmithKline got a big share in a South African company called Aspen. The commission had concerns about the intellectual property rights that Glaxo had over a particular drug, Abacavir, which is an antiretroviral product, and we made it a condition of that merger that GlaxoSmithKline should extend its licenses for generic manufacturers to manufacture generic versions of this product, to that those licenses be extended to other players in order to ensure that there was a good kind of competitive balance with respect to that particular product. Okay, then to focus a little bit on our advocacy work. I mean, what the slide doesn't tell you, and it's in the annual report, is we have a lot of interactions with the whole range of policymakers, government departments, other regulators, on a whole range of issues. But perhaps our biggest focus in terms of advocacy in the year under review, indeed in the current year, is to deal with issues of bid rigging. In the public sector in particular. This is when a tender is put out and firms, private sector firms, don't tender for it competitively. They collude with each other when they put in their bids. In other words, they decide beforehand who's going to win and who's going to lose, and they rig their bids. They tender collusively, and of course when that happens, the prices are much higher than they would have been if these bids were being bid for in a competitive manner. And it kind of, this is the part that raises the cost to government as well. Government is paying more for these projects than they would have paid if collusion was not happening. So we were kind of receiving a lot of complaints about this. There were a lot of cases coming up, and we decided that, look, in addition to pursuing the cases, in addition to kind of prosecuting those people who have done this in the past, what we also need to do is we need to kind of just get better practice going amongst procurement officials in government in particular to prevent this from happening in the first instance. So while we go for those people who did it in the past, going forward, we must just set up better practices to kind of prevent bid rigging from occurring. So we came up with quite a big program where we produced materials and we held workshops with a whole range of government departments, kind of looking at how, you know, training procurement officials essentially on how to prevent, detect and report bid rigging. You know, the obvious thing is if you've got like two bids from the same fax machine, you can kind of assume that somebody was colluding, but it doesn't occur to officials to look at that and say, hey, these both things came from the same fax machine. And this has been a big project that we've worked very, very closely with National Treasury with, because they are the custodians of procurement policy. We've commented on a number of their policy, a number of their policies regarding this. And then recently, in July this year, outside of the period now that we're looking at, National Treasury has issued a practice note in terms of the PFMA requiring all tenderers to sign a certificate of independent bid determination. So in other words, everybody who tenders for a government project must sign a legal document saying, I did not collude with anybody else in deciding, in determining my bid. And that becomes a legal document that they can be prosecuted over should it be found that that is not true. Okay, and they admit and they agree there that, you know, should it be found to not true, they will be subject to both prosecution by the competition authorities as well as, you know, they will be personally liable for criminal prosecution for essentially lying in signing that document. Okay. You know, South Africa is kind of a very South African competition agencies have are very well regarded in the international community. We have a very good reputation as being a very thorough and solid organization. You know, the kind of, for example, it's come to my attention recently that decisions of the competition tribunal are the subject of kind of academic study at universities. You know, people are kind of reading these documents and teachers are teaching their students using our decisions and our material. We get called upon by all kinds of people to kind of contribute to the developed capacity building in other African agencies and other developing country agencies. We have a very good reputation internationally for championing the concerns and needs of developing countries in an area that, quite frankly, is dominated mostly by developed country agencies. So we've participated quite a lot in international work. We together with the SARS on tax, are the only two South African agencies that have observer status in the OECD, which we participate in by sending kind of papers and participating in the debates that occur there. I sit on the steering group of the International Competition Network, and we often called upon by the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, which has a subcommittee dealing on competition, to participate in their proceedings. Most significantly, though, it's something we kind of committed to and feel that we can play a very important role in, is developing the capacities in other of competition agencies in other southern African countries, which we pay a fair amount of attention to. So through, we've been involved in an initiative to set up an African competition forum. We participate in SADC's competition committee. We've had a joint food project with Zambia and Egypt, who are also interested in food markets, where we kind of together with them worked out methodologies of how you tackle problems in food markets. We have a very good relationship with Namibia, who's very recently set up their competition authority. We've had an statistics around our communications. We've had our communication internally in the organization has improved. We have a number of different discussion forums where staff get together and share their work with other staff. This is the content of our work, so people have an opportunity to test ideas and test their approaches and methods and ways in which they've gone about tackling other problems and sharing it with other staff. We have regular staff meetings once a month. We put out an internal newspaper. We've had very good media coverage in the external media. We've put out 19 press releases, but we've had many media coverage way beyond that. In one methodology of using kind of measuring our media coverage, it's amounted to 145 million rand. Because, 145 billion rand. Million rand. Okay, human resources is another area of major success for us, although it's never something you can be complacent about in an organization that has so many demands on it and in such a pressurized environment. The Competition Commission, for the second year in a row, that's in the year under review, won the Deloitte's Best Company to Work For in the Public Sector Award. This comes after a period where there were, if you look at our first strategic plan, for example, one of our big strategic objectives was to kind of improve staff morale and improve the skills levels of staff. At that time, we were having a high staff turnover. Our staff were being poached by the private sector in quite a kind of serious way. We were kind of getting new people, training them, and before we kind of reap the benefits of our investment in their training, they would be poached by the private sector that was kind of offering them enormously higher salaries, significantly better salaries than we were able to offer. It was a bit of a kind of demotivating thing for staff. And we've done another number of things where we're on the other side of that now, clearly. We went through a process, and in the period under review, we implemented the results of a salary benchmarking exercise we did, where we kind of looked at, the big issue was why aren't we able to compete on salaries with the private sector? So we benchmarked our salaries, and we've improved our salaries on the basis of that benchmarking exercise, and made them in a way that's completely aligned with government public sector salaries. We've continued to kind of, with our graduate trainee program, we kind of regularly get, in the period under review, had 11 graduate trainees. This is a regular thing that occurs in the tribunal, where essentially we get recent graduates and train them, and kind of train them in our work. Invest a lot in them. Most of them leave, but there's a lot of people that remain in the organization, and it's like a big source for us of developing skills in the organization. And another very significant thing that occurred for the first time in the period under review and is continuing in the current period is our management development program. Here I've explained this previously, but it's worth repeating, is that you'd appreciate that in an organization like ours, to gain seniority in an organization, in this organization, means that essentially you've got to take on more and more management responsibilities. And the kinds of people we attract in the first instance are very highly technically skilled people. They're good lawyers and they're good economists. But they just don't have management experience for very good reasons. But then we are promoting them in the organization, and in a sense you set them up to fail if you don't kind of, improve their management skills. And so we've got this was a big, important strategic thing we did, a program to improve the middle management, the skills of middle management got we put out a tender for the project, and we've got a program that was specifically designed and tailored for the management of an institution like ours, and 20 people, senior kind of middle management layer people went through it in the period under review, and another 20 is currently going through it. So it's over a 2-year period, and we'll come out of it with a set of training materials, and we'll look at whether we want to reproduce that, perhaps at a lower key, or improve on that as we go forward. Questions around, you don't need 3 graphs here over 3 years, because they all tell you it's pretty much the same thing, but this is our employment equity divided by race, by racial categories. I've made this point before, but as an institution that only came into being in the post-94 period, you know, when we started in the year 2000, we're not an institution that kind of had to change, to readjust. We could start afresh. So we've never had problems around the issue of equity, employment equity in an overall sense, because we started on a blank slate, as it were. The employment equity regarding gender is pretty much 50-50. I should in fairness point out that this does not reflect at all layers in the organization, particularly at the kind of very senior management layer. There is a predominance of males over females, but otherwise overall it kind of complies with equity principles. Another big, very big area of strategic importance to us, and I'm kind of saying these are the kinds of things we're spending a lot of money on, like the management development program and now IT, so it's worth kind of reporting on, is IT and knowledge management. And you'll appreciate that with the number of cases we have and the number of sectors we're dealing in, the economy-wide nature of our work, and the fact that we can't always get expertise in every single sector that we work in, the way that we kind of gather and share knowledge is a very, very important thing for an organization like ours. And we're in the tail end, the last parts of putting together a knowledge management system in the organization that is designed to integrate with our case management system. It will lead to kind of improved collaboration between kind of staff and divisions, and sharing information and accessing information, and in reporting on the kind of on what's happening in various parts of the organization and various cases and the sectors. This will be completed in the next financial year. It's been quite a kind of technical process, both in terms of kind of working out what kinds of information we need and working out the workflow in the organizations that require different parts of the workflow that require different kinds of information on one hand, but also as it goes, the knowledge management system, kind of, you need to get software developed, you need software designers to kind of put it all together and make and create an interface, an IT interface that is friendly and user friendly, and then you need to kind of change the work culture of people to say, well, you know, to get people who are used to printing documents to use it in the electronic form to be able to search for information. So it's a very big project, it'll be completed in the next financial, in the current financial year, most of it. And we, you know, so but the cultural thing before, the work culture we still have to work on in order to get people to be able to use the system properly. And we're convinced that this is something that will kind of take us, you know, to the cutting edge of knowledge management. reported on in our annual report. We've had an unqualified audit report this year for the fifth year, successive year. The one big major issue that the AG has pointed out to us is the manner in which we have set our performance targets. The criticism is that our 23% of these performance targets were not set in us using the SMART methodology. Some of this has occurred because, you know, we've kind of, in previous years, gotten away with constructing it in that way, and then suddenly there was a change. We never felt that we needed to kind of accurately set targets, because a lot of our work is demand driven. You know, you can never, we felt, predict how many mergers there's going to be in the economy for next year, or how many people are going to complain. We couldn't put numbers to those. And so where we kind of didn't, they said, look, you've got to kind of, you've got enough experience now to make guesses around this, you need to set these targets. And so we, subsequent to that, currently, you'll see in our next plans, is we've got a whole project to kind of revise the way we've drawn up our performance targets. If you look, for example, in the current report that you have in front of you, our targets are, according to the Auditor General, way too detailed. There's too much in detail. They of course have to audit this. So some of our targets, some of the way in which we've laid it out is very managerial rather than a big picture. You know, it's like very, very small tasks, getting targets rather than just the big picture outcomes. We've got a project working on that now to kind of refine that and make them kind of more appropriate for the kind of reporting that we need to do. Then at the end, and the details are in the report, you'll see that our financial performance this year compared to the previous year, you'll see some of the points I've made here about fee income dropping from 50.5 million to 30.38 million as a consequence of the raising of the merger threshold, and government grants increasing from 44 to 80, both as a consequence of that and as a consequence of increased activity. The largest expenditure for an organization like this is as our employees. Our work is basically the kind of intellectual capital that resides in the heads of the teams, basically. Our operating expenses was pretty kind of constant, I think. And we've kind of pretty much kept the kind of budget that we set out in that year. One of the things that happened in that year is that we did get towards an end of the year, when we kind of realized that there was a chance that we would spend an additional grant from EDP that kind of covered the additional expenditure that we hadn't kind of received money for. A point I've kind of made often in the last few times that I've been here is that, you know, with all the planning that we've done, we've put together budgets to our government department that were fairly ambitious in terms of expanding the capacity of the organization. And we've never kind of received all of what we've asked for. We've always kind of received considerably less and then have to make further representation to get more money. And just to say that kind of whole process of not being certain up front about how much money you have takes up a lot of management time and replanning and reallocating budgets. And I think I'm hoping that will kind of settle down now going forward. You know, we have had the kind of problem of changing departments and promises being made to give us more money that didn't materialize yet.
me that you always present and provide and present professional documents and in a professional manner. I wish other entities can learn really from you. I think the way you prepare documents, very satisfactory, and I hope that others will emulate you. We also want to congratulate you for receiving an unqualified audit report for the 5 consecutive years. I think that's a very good work. We need to congratulate you and commend you on that. It's something to write home about, and we hope as the AG is continuing to do performance or outcome based performance audit, you will also continue to receive such outcomes. Thank you very much. Members, this is the report, the annual report from the Competition Commission. Let's interact with it. Mr. Marais, Mr. Julie, Dr. Ravi, Dr. Huang, in that order, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. A few of my questions will be very easy and very simple questions, maybe a very straightforward answer is probably enough. The first one is just, you know, in terms of a clarification of your role. You respond and act only when you get complaints, or do you act proactively as well? In other words, identify possible problems in the market yourself. Together with that, do you also go to court with certain cases? In which cases do you refer to the tribunal, and in what cases do you yourself take the transgressors or the perceived transgressors to court? That's just the first one. Then in terms of and in this case I'll play a bit of a devil's advocate. In the iron and steel industry, and specifically what we've lately seen with ArcelorMittal and Kumba and various intrigue BEE transactions, where you will see that individuals come up in certain cases and eventually somehow that linked to each other. Specifically, you know, what I know about ArcelorMittal, who's got the, you know, we know his position in terms of steel production and how to get involved in terms of the ore itself. Now, to what extent do you respond to things like that? Because that clearly is some of the causes of the iron and steel prices eventually then filtered down to the consumers. And then specifically with regards, I mean, BEE and specifically broad-based black economic empowerment is absolutely essential. Nobody argues against that. But I think what we have seen and experienced is to a certain extent narrow-based black economic empowerment. And again, where it seems like that has been used in many cases where people get remunerated enormous amount of money just to get certain contracts or perceived certain contracts. To what extent do you investigate those kind of things? Because eventually, you know, if someone get R1 billion for a transaction, eventually the consumer must pay for that. So all of that filters down to somehow the consumer will have to foot the bill. Then in terms of the banking industry, and I heard what you said, that they've got their own regulators, which is quite correct. And the following thing that I'm going to say, it depends on whether you're an investor in the bank or a consumer that must pay fees and interest rates. Somehow it seems like a coincidence that, I mean, all of them belongs to the Banking Association of South Africa. And somehow, you know, the fees are very much related to each other. And somehow when the The Reserve Bank dropped their rate, everybody drops their prime rate, but exactly the same. And there's no difference. Absolutely no difference, and the same day, same time, everything. To what extent does that cause a red light? And to what extent are you getting involved in that? Because that is beyond regulatory. It's beyond regulatory. They might fully comply with regulatory aspects, but there might be this coincidence. Then, which links to the next one, links to your international and probably international trade as well. To what extent do you get queries and complaints from or originated from low value imports or possible fraudulent imports that causes unfair competition in the local market? And it's not only imports from China, but it can also be overalls manufactured in Lesotho and then sold in South Africa, and putting businesses in the Eastern Cape out of business and people losing their jobs, and eventually the consumer must foot the bill. Then the last two small points is very, very small. The one is just on your employment. Now, you've given us your employment equity. You've said nothing about employment of people with disabilities. Now, in terms of my knowledge, you've got a target of 2%. So somehow, if you are less company to work for, surely that must be part of that as well. You have said nothing about that. I'd really like to know more about that and how do you do in that regard. And then just lastly, in terms of your financial performance, you compare it to the previous year. I would very much like to see that being compared to the budget, your budget. So in other words, to what extent have you spent or over your budget in terms of certain issues or in terms of your revenue as well, that one can just compare that with each other. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, that's just in there. I want to check with the commissioner the reason for the companies to appeal. What do they gain? Because you said usually they prefer to go for settlement. Now you said there's a new tendency of wanting to appeal to go to court. What do they gain? I mean, if you weigh the settlement and going to court, is it because they want to delay the process and then at the end, what do they benefit? Secondly, the bid rigging. Yeah, I see. It is very difficult, particularly with the department or government procurement, where you find people when they come to do work with the government, then they increase or inflate the prices or quotations. But I believe in the government there is an expertise, or I will say the quantities are there, so we'll be able to quantify the amount of work to be done. How do they beat that? Is it I'll say so. Then lastly, I remember you said the reason you are not for punitive measures, but just for preventative measures. Now, I heard you saying that because of this rigging, now you want to punish. I mean, do you need legislation for that? Or if you can elaborate on that. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I think it was a very impressive submission of yours. I think I'd like to congratulate you. I think it's really the Competition Commission is really setting an example to many other state agencies and so forth. But my two questions basically relate. First and foremost, Madam Chair, to the Sasol chemical industries, we spoke about the escalation in the price of bread and the fact that Pioneer was fined something like 195 million rand. But still, I think that the escalation in the price of bread has affected the ordinary consumer in this country to a tremendous extent. I mean, I can see it every day. If I go to the supermarkets and so on, people are really counting their cents for the bread and so forth. So I'd like to know, Sasol and so forth, is it possible that there'll be a decline in the price of bread or something like that? I'd like to have your views on that. And the second thing is the construction industry, Madam Chair. It's very labour intensive and so forth. But I've spoken to quite a number of builders in my constituency, and they say that the price of cement has really gone up. I don't know whether it's because of the escalation in the price of electricity or something, but I think they charge them something like 70 rand for a pocket of cement these days. And he says that they are investigating the cement industry, but he says that it's possible to import cement at half the price at what it's currently being priced in this country. I'd like to have the Commissioner's views on that as well, because, I mean, whether we like it or not, the construction industry is providing labour, it's labour intensive and so forth, and at the moment they are really battling to make ends meet and so forth. So I think it's very needed to investigate the price of cement, because with my considered opinion, I don't have all the facts to my information, is that the price at the moment is stifling entrepreneurship, especially in the small in housing and so forth. And I'd like to have the views of the Commissioner regarding the price of cement and the other accessories as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Rabbit.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, thank you for the commission, your presentation. Regarding for the your report about for the penalty, your penalty is the total amount is 487 million you have. Then you say only for 80 million come to the competition. Your side is 18 or 80?
80.
80. So if for the 80 million from the your financial statement inside your income, free income, I can't see the way the 80 million come from your income. So also this because this 80, if 80 come from this penalty side come to the your income statement. So from your 2009-2010, your income is a free income only for about 30 million and 50 million for 2009. Also, this is one question. And the other question is you only get 80 million. Why? How you can calculate for 480 million, you only can get 80 million. What the regulation say you only can get 80 million? How can calculate this? Because from the your income statement and all the inside, you still pay the all cost by cash. You pay a lot of money. You pay the 20 million for the cash related the cost, and the tribunal, your fee paid to the tribunal is the 6 million. So you still pay the all the court case. Then you win this case, you get the penalty, you get the 80 million. So I don't see you from this inside is how can calculate is 480 million or you only can get you can have the 80 million other money or go to the national treasury. And from your report you say is AG report say you only 23% is not smart. Why you say you are not smart? So I because you have the internal audit committee, yeah? So I think this audit issue is not only from this your side entity, other national entity also got the same problem. Yeah? I think as the chairperson already announced, is congratulated your audit report. Yeah? But from the auditor general is reported. This page, he mentioned is very clear. Yeah? So she, they're so unhappy for the UN internal audit. Yeah. So you, that they say you are still did not have the sufficient monitoring control. So I hope you can explain this one. Then from the your the 2010 to 2013 this financial budget. I see the 2010 and 11 you store the surplus 63 million every year. You never got a surplus. So, but you win the order case, get all the bigger money. Why you still keep the your side is the deficit? So I need to know this because your staff is at the more your cost from the your total expenditure is. Every year is an increase over the, I think it's over the 30%. But your revenue is never can increase over the 30%. How you can cover for your balance? So I hope this one you can explain to me. Also from the your previous the reports, I quite interested in this one, but not in today this report. You are the focus for the 2006 to 2009. Your strategical focus is for the staff to increase the morale and the motivation. But your 2010 to 2013 for your strategical plan, you didn't highlight for this one. This means you already improving for the lead. So this one I also like more details of how you improving.
Thanks, Dr. Wang. Mr. Wenyama.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think I'd like also to start with the precursor of saying that definitely this report is quite a comprehensive report and very clear. Does set a very, very strong benchmark for the reports, in my view. For a good report. The issue is measures notification, and which has led to a downward trend. As a result of the file fees, that's what is being maybe speculated. I wanted to understand more on this. It's a information seeking question.
Thanks, Sangwenyama. Yes, I'll ask my question in the next round. Thank you. You may respond.
Thank you very much. Mr. Maria's first question was about how complaints occur. Well, the answer to your question is all of the above. What can happen in terms of the Competition Act is a member of the public can make a complaint, and we must investigate, and we must look at whether first it's a valid complaint, whether we have jurisdiction over it. You know, there's a lot of people who complain to us about things that we can't do anything about because it's not, doesn't fall under our legislation. We don't have jurisdiction over. So insofar as it does, we're obliged to pursue it, and if there's a case to be made, if we can find the evidence, you know, then we're obliged to pursue it. But in addition to that, the commissioner is also given the power to initiate his or her own cases, and in the graph we showed you that what's been happening in the recent past is there's been an increase in the number of initiations by the commissioner. As the commission, as an institution, gets more experience and gains more knowledge about what's going on in markets, we'll kind of put together cases as appropriate. Then what happens, okay, so we look if we find there's a case to be made, we'll then put together a report and send it to the tribunal, and that's the body that adjudicates the matter according to kind of principles of natural justice and according to principles enshrined in the Constitution. So of course can't just decide, must give the other party a chance to give it its side of the story. There'll be an exchange of documents. These are pretty much like court proceedings, and then give anybody else a chance to kind of say what they need to say, and then based on the evidence we'll make a ruling. So the tribunal, even though it's an administrative tribunal, has decisions that carry the status of a high court. It is so it's effectively the court of first instance. Now, if somebody is not happy with the decision of the tribunal, then the Act says they can appeal that decision to the Competition Appeal Court, which is now a specialist court within the High Court. It has its own judge president, Judge Dennis Davis, and they decide only on competition matters. The legislation envisaged that would be the final court on competition matters, and then from there any other matter must go directly to the Constitutional Court for any further appeal. But what happened is that in one of the cases, that provision of our law, it's argued, is not consistent with kind of other provisions and other laws that says that, you know, the Supreme Court of Appeal is a court of appeal. You can't bypass it. So what there's a tendency to happen now is for people to take decisions of the Competition Appeal Court and appeal it at the Supreme Court of Appeal. And then it goes to the High Court, the Constitutional Court. So you see there's now all these layers of appeal. This is all a consequence of the kind of, you know, the pro-rights ethos of our Constitution. That's just how it is. You can, you know, that's the nature of the policy decisions we've taken around these issues. But it does certainly create opportunities for people to use the system to frustrate public institutions like ours, you know, to wear us down, basically. I mean, there was one case, the case with ANSAC, I don't know if you recall, the American Natural Soda Ash Corporation. They took us to every court in the country. They got kicked out of the Constitutional Court. They didn't even entertain their matter. And then they just frustrated us. And after 7 years, they then kind of settled with us on grounds that we were happy to settle on right at the beginning, which comes to a kind of point, another question asked somewhere along the line, is why do companies do this? Now, of course, you can't kind of accuse any, but I'm making a general point about people who kind of will, you know, there'll be a tendency to frustrate the process. I can't point a finger and say, you are doing this. Everybody will invoke very good constitutional grounds. They have rights. They want to pursue their rights. We got it wrong. They all will make very convincing legal arguments as to why they have a right to do this. And that would be their formal and official view. But, you know, one can't help but conclude that there's a chance that they are doing it just to frustrate us, to wear us down, to kind of get us to back off. Or alternatively, that they've made a very intelligent calculation to say, look, it's going to cost us far less. If you compare how much it's going to cost us to keep this matter away from a final decision, to just frustrate it and keep it carrying on, and how much of money we'll pay for lawyers to keep this thing going on the one hand, compared to how much of profit we could make if we continue the behavior that they want us to stop. And if they do the calculation, they might well say, look, it's worth our while to just keep this thing going in the courts because we'll, you know, when you balance it off, right? I mean, that could well be the case. I can't be saying that against any particular, but that's a logical kind of thing one can conclude might be occurring here. I mean, interestingly, on that point, what few more organizations, is beginning to carry some weight in these decisions, because companies also have to worry about their reputations, and reputational harm is something that if it gives a company a bad name, it has consequences. You know, Tiger Brands having a bad name amongst consumers is not good for a business. Or Sasol having a bad name amongst policymakers who might be deciding industrial policy, you know, I don't know, tax breaks or whatever the case is, you know, that might benefit them, is not going to be good for them if policymakers are saying, look, we're not going to give you this benefit if you're going to behave in that way. So I think that that's a very, there's a big part of our work that gets done by other people's thinking, and whether they kind of back it up or don't back it up, or how strongly they feel about something, because that goes to the reputational harm that can be inflicted on a company. Okay, there's the question around iron and steel and ArcelorMittal and black economic empowerment. I think that you know, I hear your point. The bottom line of the answer to your question is that while a lot of things occurring in business transactions might be in the name of BE or outside the name of BE might be very offensive to you and me or to anybody, some of these matters are not competition matters that we have jurisdiction over to deal with. We don't always have we don't have a law enabling us to condemn or not condemn or say this is right or wrong in some of, I'm being very general here, and I think some of your questions are around that. Certainly the matter regarding Kumba is something that I think should come to, will necessarily come to the tribune, to the commission for insofar as it constitutes a merger, for approval in terms of merger grounds, and we will look at it in the normal course that we will look at it. And the point about the kind of integration issue around, you know, coal versus as being an input to iron ore rather, and coal for that matter being an input to steel, is something that will be taken into account in that analysis, and it would be really unfair for me to kind of preempt what we might think about that. Your questions around banking, yes, you know, but all of these people are Barca members. Just as an aside, to say that we have found in the course of our work of a whole range of different sectors that a particular problem we have is the way in which industry associations fulfill their roles. Because industry associations historically have done things that we now consider to be anti-competitive, and some of those behaviors do continue in the current period. And so while industry associations have very legitimate reasons for existing, you know, to set standards and to do, there's legitimate reasons, they could cross the line and be involved in facilitating collusive behavior amongst their members. This is something we completely and on top of. In other words, the manner in which industry associations facilitate information exchange between its members could become a very, very anti-competitive thing. In other words, they are the secretariat for the cartel. They're the people who send out the information. And in a number of cases we're dealing with that issue of how industry associations kind of facilitate information exchange. Whether the Reserve Bank dropping charges and everybody following is anti-competitive or not, you know, I think there are kind of persuasive views that there's always a kind of leader in a market that everybody follows, and that's not necessarily a collusive thing. You know, you could do it. You saw somebody else change their price and you hearing then. It's not like you sat down before and decided to change the price in a particular way. I think that around, just to say, make some more very general points about the banking industry, is one of the things that really put us in a very difficult situation is just at the time that we finished our banking inquiry, like just at that time, man, right at that moment, the world was hit with this financial crisis. And everybody was kind of very sensitive to this. It was like the stakes were big here. You don't make mistakes. You don't say things that kind of give you a bad name internationally or creates doubts about the integrity of your financial system. You know, so there was a lot of sensitivities around that. And we had to manage the release of our banking inquiry report in this very difficult context. And we were all sensitive to it because, you know, I mean, for developing countries in particular, if you get a bad name, it's like, you know, if our banking inquiry report got interpreted as things do in the financial sector because there's so much a kind of sentiment and gossip around it, as us saying, well, South Africa's financial sector has weaknesses and has problems, it would have just kind of made things worse. So we had to deal with it sensitively. Having said that, I think that part of what has emerged since is that part of the problem is that banking regulators are too narrow-minded about wanting to prevent what they call systemic risk. They're very narrow-minded about that. That's all they want to protect. They don't, you know, the integrity of the financial system is just nothing must interfere in it. You tell them, yeah, but you need more competition. They don't care about that as long as it's kind of, you know. And I think that what's happening recently since then, and I know that Treasury people are taking this thinking on board, is that, you know, the regulators, financial sector regulators, can't be so narrowly focused. They must begin to see how other issues, in particular competition issues, affect those markets as well. And certainly, you know, from my interaction with National Treasury and the whole international trend around rethinking financial sector regulation, there's thought being put into how you could stop being so narrowly focused. Then there's questions. The question about fraudulent imports, look, this is a trade issue. This is a kind of an issue related to import controls, border controls, you know, customs and excise. That's the kind of terrain that kind of dealing with these issues are. And it's not something that kind of directly we take action against. So, you know, fraudulent imports insofar as they counterfeit goods is this criminal activity that customs and excise must take into account and prosecute. That's it. You know, insofar as there's high tariff barriers or no tariff barriers, you know, say there's no tariff barriers, goods are coming in cheaply and South African products can't compete with it, that's a matter for the people who set tariffs. You know, tariffs, that's another policy instrument. That's to go to the tariffs people to say to raise or decrease the tariffs. But in a kind of globalized world, raising tariffs is not like the thing people do anymore because everybody's kind of committed to global competition. Lesotho is part of SACU, so it doesn't kind of apply in the same way. We've got we have the same customs union. We kind of consider it, at least in world terms, as part of the same. Our border, we don't have a border with Lesotho effect with respect to trade. Disabilities, there are two people in the Competition Commission with disabilities. That's not there. There are two people. That doesn't equal 2%. It's less than 2%. But that's where we're at. And your point about comparing with budgets rigging, yes. I mean, prices are inflated. I'm not sure what your question there was, but I mean, I think that part of the kind of work that we're doing around the proactive measures that procuring government departments must put into place emphasizes that you know, that there needs to be higher levels of kind of expertise within government itself in evaluating these bids in order to work out whether they are competitive or whether somebody is just taking a chance and putting a higher price than they should. Your point around kind of surveyors as well is well taken. You must tell me if I haven't answered that question, because if you have a different take on it, you can. Your question about not punitive but preventative, and do we need legislation? No, we don't need legislation. The only point I was making there is that considering the high number of cases we were getting in bid rigging, it just made sense to kind of say, look, there's a big problem here. We can deal with all the people who've done bad things in the past, but let's also, going forward, put into place a whole lot of mechanisms to ensure this doesn't happen going forward. So we have a two-track process of prosecuting those people in terms of existing law that we have the powers to do, of prosecuting those people who've broken the law in the past and making sure it doesn't happen again in the future. So, you know, it's just not. So that's the preventative side, is the latter side. Mr. Robbie's question around the price of bread is a perennial question that I must admit often stumps me. But we can unpack some of that. I think that, you know, when the price of bread went up at the time that it did, it was a very unfortunate thing that happened in terms of the sequence. What happened is the Competition Commission announces this fine, and then the companies raise their price, and everybody concludes that what has happened is the company raised its price in order to pay the fine. Okay, I mean, that seemed like a very logical thing to do given the sequence of events. But, you know, that is a patently very untrue thing. We've kind of, in fact, at our last conference, Competition Commission conference, there were three papers on this issue, on asking the question, does fining a company, is the fine passed on to the consumer? Okay. And I can tell you very confidently that's not the case, because this is a one-off fine that gets paid. There's a whole range of reasons why it won't be passed on to the consumer. So, for example, the company that got corporate leniency, it had no reason to raise its bread price at the same time either. Why did it do it? You know, if it was really clever and those other guys were kind of, the people who paid a fine were passing it on to the consumers, what would happen is those people who didn't pay a fine wouldn't pass it on to the consumers. Their product would be cheaper, they would gain market share. Okay? So you know, that's what we're trying to do, is get like markets to self adjust. What really, the truth of the matter, what happened in that period is that one of the other timing issues is at the same time that all of this was happening, in other words, us kind of finding them, the wheat price went up. It went up internationally. That, you know, you'll see the price of wheat, the graph tells you it's gone up. And the higher bread price was a response to higher wheat prices, clearly, not the fine. It's a very difficult thing, this, for me, because I find that even I can produce all the graphs and all the things around what happened, people still want to make the connection between the fine and being passed on to consumers. But there's a lot of academic work on this thing, you know, that as well that I can look at and kind of if you want to kind of look at it further. Um, prices in the building industry, you know, like I've said, we have a number of cases of collusive prices in building products, amongst them cement, clearly. I mean, these prices are collusively determined, which means they are higher than they would have been if they were competitively determined. Okay? How much higher, I can't tell you. I mean, that's like for a business, you know, each of the businesses to work out. I mean, it would be interesting to see that, you know, in the last year or so, we've kind of started these cases against all of these products, a whole range, including bricks and pipes and all kinds of other products as well. What happens in these markets and how these prices adjust now, considering we have all these cases, and what ought to happen is our interventions here through these cases ought to be disrupting these cartels. They should be now not talking to each other, and over some period of time we'll see whether prices fall or not. But your general point about, you know, builders finding prices higher, you know, we can kind of confirm that that is the case insofar as we have found that there's collusive behavior in the determination of the prices of some of the products in the building. Okay, Mr. Wong's question. I think what we need to look at here is page. Is that the page you were looking at when you were giving me these figures?
Which page you are now talking?
62.
62. 62. Yes,
62.
Here.
Okay, you know, you were trying to kind of work out how. Oh, I think there's 2 points here, right? Let's just work out how the Competition Commission gets money on the income side. Okay? The first point that Wendy answers your question is the fines that come through to us is not reflected in our financial statements. Right? I think that's the confusing thing here. You will never find a 487 million rand of fines in our financial statements. And that's because we get the money and it goes to the National Revenue Fund. We are looking at it because because it is confusing. Everybody is expecting to say 487. I can't see that yet. Where is it? I think that we some advice from our kind of accountants and auditors is that we ought to reflect it because it's money that's still coming. You know, we can just say it comes in, goes out. Yeah. Not reflecting it is kind of not accounting for it in some way. And in fact, it goes further than that. What happens to this money is we get the money, we send it to the government department. The government department sends it to the National Revenue Fund. And it gets lost in that process. It's not kind of earmarked as a special amount coming from us. Now, when it goes to the government department and they do their accounting, they might not have any money to send through because they have so there is a problem around that, and it is my view that in fact we should be reflecting it in our financial statements. This issue never arose for us before the past 2 or 3 years because we weren't receiving large amounts of funds.
Can I come in this point?
It's only in the recent past that we started receiving these funds. So, Mr. Wong, does that answer a lot of your questions? Does the fact that it doesn't appear here, right? Hopefully, because that's one of the questions you asked. The penalties don't appear here. Your question about the question is how do we get our income? Our income comes from essentially two sources. It comes from our filing fees that we get from mergers, which we keep, and then we present a budget to government, and they top it up according to our budget by government transfer. So and I've reported this consistently, in the budget that we've put through to government, you're absolutely right, we had very large, major, in one case, over 30% increase in the in our request to budget, and you're absolutely right, over 30% increase in spending is perhaps, you know, not something that kind of washes down well to decision makers. How can you increase so suddenly by such a big amount? And I think that's a lesson we certainly have learned. But just remember how we arrived at that. We arrived at that in a context where we had been doing very serious work around planning, strategic planning, and it was truly in a context where a lot of decision makers, policy makers, the president, the minister, were making public comments and statements that they were going to give us more resources. This was happening. You know, give the commission more resources. Thabo Mbeki's speech, we're going to give the commission more resources. You know, the Minister of Finance speech, we're going to give the commission more resources. So, you know, we did the kind of logical thing and were ambitious in our plan to the extent that we wanted, yes, a 30% increase, but then when it went to the kind of decision makers who look at it in a different way, they were saying this is too much, we can't increase it that much, and therefore they gave us less than we asked for. And that's the only explanation of what happened there. Your question around the AG's comment about 23% being not smart, this is a question around, I've explained it before, that where we were not able to predict accurately something that was outside of our control, like how many people are going to complain about, you know, an abuse case. I really can't tell you in the next year. How many mergers are going to be notified to us in the next year? I can't tell you accurately. I've come to appreciate that we need to make some kind of judgment call around what it's likely to be in, you know, after this last audit. But we had, in a number of places in our in the way we wrote up our plan, that something was ongoing. Something was we couldn't determine, and those are the ones they picked out and said, you know, 23% of your objectives are not SMART. Now, SMART is an acronym, right, for objectives that are specific, measurable, accurate, reliable, and time bound. You know, that it kind of meets all those criteria. So some of ours went time bound, some of ours went very specific because we were. We can't proactively. We can't, for example, when you proceed with a case, I can't tell you in which case the party is going to take us an appeal. I can't even predict in which how many cases we might win or lose with accuracy. You know, so those were the things where we were saying, like, we want a lot of money for cases that are going to go on appeal, but we can't tell you how many people are going to appeal cases because we really don't know. And I think that the National Treasury and the people who kind of previously were saying everything must be smart and everything must be well planned and everything is a project, there is an increasing appreciation that in the kinds of work that we're doing, you can't be there or you can't be 100% smart. An organization like us, for example, we do need a little contingency fund just in case somebody takes us on appeal. And, you know, we need that fund. We can't say when somebody takes us on appeal, oh, we can't counter this appeal because we have no money. And, you know, so it's kind of, so that's the kind of trap we're in around that. And I think there's a lot of honest discussions we're having with the Auditor General around that. The question on staff morale, you're quite right, in the 2006-2009 period, that was a big issue in the Commission. It was the period hopefully created some level of unsettling of staff. There was a big kind of ethos in the organization that to make it in this field, you had to be poached by a reputable law firm, and people were kind of, you know, being poached. That's how they saw their career advancement. People who got left behind and were not being poached felt that they were perhaps not as good as those people that left. There was some level of demotivation. Our salaries were not up to standard. Our salaries were kind of sometimes lower than government department salaries. And we put into place a whole range of different mechanisms to deal with that. Amongst those, the salary benchmarking, the kind of regrading of positions properly, a whole regrading exercise. These are long exercises. They take my time. You need external data, consultants working on it. And so we've done the job descriptions, the salaries, and demonstrated our kind of commitment to training and development. And between those three things and just kind of regular staff meetings, better communication with staff, I think we've kind of turned that around considerably. I wouldn't kind of by any means say that's a problem now. You know, it's something we need to maintain. We should never take for granted. But it's not something we kind of with a big strategic issue. It's not the biggest strategic issue. The final question is around merger notification, and here, okay, so this is about how merger notification takes place. What happens is the Act says that through regulations, the authority will set two thresholds. So there's two thresholds, okay? These thresholds are calculated on the basis of the turnover and the asset values of the merging parties, the acquiring target firms. So there's two thresholds. Everything that is above the higher threshold is considered a large merger. Everything that's between the two thresholds is considered an intermediate merger. And everything below the bottom threshold is a small merger. Okay, so that's how we classify large, intermediate, and small mergers. And each of these categories get treated differently in the way they go to the authorities. The small mergers, you don't have to notify us, but if we feel as an agency that we want you to notify the agency, we can compel you to do so. The intermediate and large mergers, you have to notify the competition commission about it. Okay, so those are compulsory notification. But even between them, they get treated differently. The intermediate mergers...
Commissioner, the thresholds, how are they calculated? Perhaps you can explain to me.
Well, they are set. They are set, basically. There's in the government gazette, we'll say that the threshold of so there's two numbers you need, a number for turnover and a number for asset value, right? And so you say, I can't remember the figures now, but everything that has an asset value, so the bottom threshold, everything that has an asset value of above 1 billion rand is the first threshold, and the second threshold is say 5 billion. I'm making up these figures, don't quote me on that, right? And similarly for the assets, and there's turnover, and there's a calculation that one does in combining them. So there's combined asset value, and so you combine them, you combine of the target and of the acquiring firm. Okay, it's a calculation basically, right? So the intermediate merger, how that gets treated, as I said, is a trial. The commission can decide it. And if you as a party is not happy with the commission's decision, you can take it on appeal to the tribunal. And they can decide on that. Okay? And that's on the intermediate. On the large merger, the commission investigates it and it makes a recommendation to the tribunal.
Mr. Ngonya must start with you, and then Dr. Wang, and then Mr. Murray.
I take it, Commissioner, because of such calculations, fees actually get bigger, and which to some extent discourages notification to be given.
Can I just follow up there, because it's a follow-up question, before we take over?
Let him finish, because
yeah.
I thought he was still continue.
Basically, because I want to understand this downward spiral that we were experiencing, is it because of that kind of calculation? And number two, completely unrelated, it's a question around the priority sectors. Food and agro.
Okay, Mr. Winner, just a second. Just a minute. I'll allow him to respond to this one so that he doesn't lose it, and then you'll get. I'm giving opportunity for the follow ups, and then we'll follow up with new questions. You may respond to that.
Okay, so sorry, I didn't talk about the fees. So we spoke about two thresholds. What happens when you raise the thresholds is that more mergers fall now under the small merger category that are not notifiable. Right? So they were here. Okay, so everything below here doesn't get notified, everything above gets. If you raise it, then all of these fall away from the system. Okay? So these are not being notified anymore. You get fewer mergers notified. Okay? What we did do is we also, when we raised the merger thresholds, we raised the fees. We did raise the fees, but it didn't balance off. In other words, we didn't raise the fees sufficiently high enough to compensate for the fees we were lost from the ones below. And the net result was we got fewer mergers and less filing fees.
What compels you to raise? Let's get that and control.
Well, what compels you to raise is the simple inflationary point that, you know, in at the time that you set these at the time that you set your original thresholds, say, and I'm sorry I can't give you figures, but say, we can put figures, but the idea is more important. Say we said, say this lower thing was 100 million rand, right? Say this was set at 100 million rand in the year 1999, right? It was 100 million rand set in the year 1999. It's still 100 million rand in the year 2009, 10 years later. Well, 100 million rand in 2009 is not the same, is not worth the same amount as it was in 2009. In fact, you know, if it was 100 million rand in 1999, in 1999 value, 100 million rand is probably 20 million rand. So you've actually brought it down because the value of money increases. So you have to kind of adjust it by an inflationary amount.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we need to understand around that, and how often to do that, and what really, like I asked, compels you to do that, and who at the end of the day has to participate in the determination of that threshold.
Very easily is that is a determination made by the minister.
Okay.
So the minister has to, and there's a process set out in the act through which the minister does it. The minister has to propose it, publish it in the public and government gazette, allow for comments to be made on it, take into account the comments, and then finally set it.
Which minister?
Well, used to be Minister of Trade and Industry, who did our last process, but going forward it will be Minister of Economic Development.
the last thresholds will get them in the which gazette?
This happened 2 years ago.
2 years ago, okay. I think it's important that we get that, and just to inform ourselves, but also to be at par with the information, the information. Dr. Huang?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think as a commissioner, you answer my question, not the full complete. Because it's important, it's 480 million. You say this money not coming directly to the your entity. But I say, who take this case against to this win this case? Because from the your entity, from your competition commissioner. So call the win the case is by you, not by the government. So this money not come to the your account, not go directly go to the national treasury. So from the your audit process, this money must become to the your account. Then from your account transfer to the national treasury or to the any the DTI anyway. Then after from the other way come to the your side 80 million. But I didn't see the your 80 million come to the your financial statement. So if the AG say you are 23% not smart, I can say you are 46% not smart. So, but it is very important because it is a big amount by the your financial statement. 480 million disappeared. Then you say you got the 80 million come from the national treasury, but the 80 million it didn't show to the inside the financial statement. This is a big is issue. Yeah? This is corrupt. I can say to you, where is the 80 million? Because you say you get a grant from the government, it's only for the 80 million plus other subsidy from DTI from somewhere. So I say this one is a big issue from my side. I say you answer this question, I very very unacceptable. Say where is the money? This money bigger to your total amount. So please, this one I need more details because you from the your financial statement the
okay.
Inside, you say performance bonus you pay. Over the 7 million for your staff and your executive. You pay the performance bonus. I don't understand why you can get the bonus then you're doing this very bad financial statement thing.
Okay, perhaps we should refer you to page 62, Dr. Huang. There is that 80 million reflected there as
no,
a grant.
Not this one.
Yeah.
Yes, the government grants and subsidies. 80.739 million.
I know, yeah, he showed the 80 million, but this is 80 million.
And the filing fees of 30 million.
He said
they appear here.
Yes.
What I think Dr. Huang is actually concerned about is the 489 million, which is not reflected here, which is your income generated by yourself. I think he says it has perhaps the chief financial officer must assist us here, so that we are able to get that amount. So that I don't know whether it is, because it has to reflect in the treasury's projections for income generation.
Can I point out order here? Because this one, I think, is a quite big difference from the shareholder side.
No, I understand what you're saying, yes.
Because the 80 million is, this I understand it's 80 million here. But I want to know, 480 million, he explained, not explained, how he get 80 million. Because every year, this penalty is different. How you can get 80 million for your budget? This budget from government side, not from your penalty side. You must explain nicely, because from chairperson's side, say, this 80 million come from this penalty side.
No. Dr. Huang.
Yes, I understand, so I want to say...
Dr. Huang, can you give
yes.
me opportunity now, please? The grant, income is generated by any department. Department of Health generates a revenue from hospitals, from everywhere. Yes, the Department of Transport, all other justice and so forth, they generate income. At the end of the day, the PFMA says that money should be redeposited into the revenue fund, the National Revenue Fund. And that is what happens. Every month they generate and then they they declare, and then they it is taken, and then every year when the budget is done, there are projections, and then there's also allocation out of that, and that to them is in a form of a grant. So that is the grant, which was 2009 44 million, 2010 I don't understand something yet. It's 80.7, which is 81 million if we were to round off. That we I think is very clear. The only thing that Dr. Wang wants to understand is where is the 489 million reflected? Because even in the auditor's statement it's not there, but in your report it is in your what is this? The report is in presentation is there. Is it something that needs to appear here? This is something we need to verify.
Page 70.
Of the of the report. I think the CFO must assist us here because we're dealing with this finances. Something that we can quickly dispose of quickly.
Chair, with reference to page 70, you see the line that says penalties collected on behalf of related parties and transferred to related parties. It says the Department of Trade and Industry, 336 million. So now there's a discrepancy on what we said, 486 and a 336. What's reflected in the financials is what we actually collected in the year. It came into our bank account, we transferred. The 487 is what we levied on the case. So hence there's a bit of discrepancy. Normally parties have a time period, you know, we'll agree I can pay over a certain period of time. So
can
hence
you can you say it very slowly? So
okay,
that we can all understand? Yes.
The 336 is the actual cash that came into our bank account and transferred through to DPI. The 487 is the fines or penalties or settlement that was agreed with the other parties. The outstanding amount. So hence there's a discrepancy of 111 million.
So where is that 111 reflected?
In other words, 400 something was a total amount.
Yes.
And out of that total, this is what has been paid in terms of tranches.
Yes.
And what you're referring to is the balance.
Still outstanding.
It's outstanding.
That's
will it be reflected somewhere where, when? In the current financial year statement?
Yes.
As money accrued? I think it is very important, this what you are saying now, and what Dr. Wang was saying. They were transferred to the Department of Trade and Industry because economic development was still accounted for under Trade and Industry. That must be very clear, Dr. Wang. It's not within the department.
Yes, I understand that.
But then there is
a
balance.
It doesn't appear in the financial statement because this money all come to their account.
No, what is done, this is a public entity the Department of, it was the Department of Trade and Industry.
Yes.
So when they receive this money, it is transferred to the department, because this department, this entity is under a particular department,
and then that
department consolidates and transfers to trade to treasury. That is the procedure.
Yeah, Chairperson, I understand it is this procedure, but anyway, the money is from the court come to your account, not the one same day you transfer to your DTI. I can't believe.
No, what happens? Yeah. Dr. Huang, there's a monthly reconciliation that happens. This is what is happening. But then this is a total amount, 336.
336.
Are you with us there?
Yeah, I'm with you, yeah.
That is the actual.
Yeah.
Although they say the total amount received is 480. The total amount levied is 486. The actual that they received is 336.
Yeah.
So they needed to explain that
in
their presentation so that it is understood in that manner.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that is the discrepancy from their reporting, I agree, because you needed Dr. Wang to ask the then he says the remainder of the money is going to be reported to in the next financial, in the next report. Are we all clear and understand and agreeing on that? I want us to move from this point.
Okay.
Let me give to Mr. Marais first and then we'll come on the same issue, Mr. Marais, so you were speaking to.
Madam Chair, I think the Commissioner has reported that, you know, in terms of the accounting practice and the advice that they've received, is that, you know, it should be seriously considered that in the future, all those should be then reflected in their accounts. Obviously, the others that are not, that is outstanding, will be a debtor, and that is normal accounting practice. And I think if that gets implemented, then from an accounting point of view, at least, you know, it complies with all the necessary regulations. So I think in terms of what they've really said, that is what must be implemented, because that is good accounting practices.
Are we not, is that what you mean? Mr. Williams?
No, I wanted to suggest that we can be able to factor that explanation in the form of a note. In other words, we create and some kind of a note within the financial statement, so that we are able to refer a person. For instance, in that 336, if there was a note, referral to note number so and so, so that is explained within that note, there will be a report.
Yeah, I think from the auditor's report, I think financial risk, the credit risk, I think is explaining there that it's something that the commission is not taking seriously. And from what I'm reading from the comments made by the auditors, it's very clear that it's something that you really need to work on. And I think it's very, very crucial that in the next reporting, we also check on this, because it is going to arise perhaps in the SCOPA, which is something that your internal audit, when they come about with the risk. Risk assessment plan, they take this into
yeah.
account. I think we should agree on that one. So it's something that doesn't arise again in the next financial year. In your report, I guess the recommendation by Mr. Ngonyam should be considered, so that we don't have to ask first before you. Any other related to this? You wanted to come in.
Just a clarification, Chair. You made the point that by regulation these monies go to the department, which then pays them over to National Treasury. So just to be clear, they don't get reflected as income in our income statement. They get reflected as a note that we collected on behalf of somebody else, namely on behalf of national of the department. That amount, and this is the point Shan was making, that just as a comparator, we use that because it's money that in fact has been generated by the fund. So it's good to refer to it, and the ongoing debate is how is that best represented in the financial statements. I think that's something we have not resolved now. The law is very clear that this money goes to the National Revenue Fund and therefore is not income.
But it's part of your annual financial assets. They don't need to be reflected?
Not in the income statement. It's money received on behalf of somebody. So in technically, it's not our income.
We agree on that. But somewhere it has to be reflected to show how much has the department, has the entity generated for the year.
Sorry, Chair. I have engaged with the auditors on this issue, and in terms of accounting standards, it's not income as defined, so hence it's not in the income statement. But what we suggested is in the accounting authority's report, when we sign off for next year, we can reflect that amount and do a sort of reconciliation between the note and what was actually levied. So it will come out clearer. But we can't reflect it as income in terms of accounting standards because it doesn't belong to us. It goes through to National Treasury.
Mm. I've also noted that the Auditor General says you don't comply to reporting standards. Yes. There's somewhere here a list of grab issues that they have raised. It's something that perhaps I thought maybe it has to do with the new audit that the audit method that they have come up with. Yes, it's somewhere. Standards and interpretations not yet effective. 74, I think. Am I interpreting it wrong? Yes, you need to clarify.
Chair, note 27 is not the audit report. It's standards that have been promulgated by the Accounting Standards Board, which we have taken to either implement or delay implementation due to the date. Some standards you can implement before the date promulgated by the Accounting Standards Board, or you can implement at the recommended date. So that's not the audit report, and the Auditor General audits according to the same standards. So
this is a note which is quite critical in as far as I'm concerned, because if it comes in under the report itself, it means it's something that you have to take note of, in my understanding. Because it is saying you have not yet effected, or the standards and interpretations not yet effective. You have not effected them.
So just in response to that, we haven't effected them because they're only effective from the 1st of April 2010.
Yes.
So it will be effected in the next financial period.
Oh, okay. All right. So the interpretation is not correct. It's fine. Can we get a follow-up from Mr. Murray?
Thank you, Chair. It is just on page 70. And I don't know if the Commissioner can talk about the remuneration of the key management. I've just done a couple of calculations, and you know, I mean, there's not a natural trend in terms of increases and bonuses and remuneration. I see the deputy commissioner even receives more than the commissioner in total. So, you know, I don't know if you can give us information on how that is determined, how the bonuses are determined. How the increases has, you know, that has been implemented, because it varies from your 10% increase, it seems like, to 38% and 27% increases, and then you know, bonuses of 16%, 13%, 15.4%, etc.
Commissioner, I'm going to allow you to respond like this. We have a challenge of time also.
Yeah. Okay, just a general point first is that, and we should have, it is reported elsewhere, but the Commission has a performance management system that all staff are subjected to, including the divisional managers and the Deputy Commissioner. And that works pretty well. It's kind of worked, you know, all staff. There's a set of rules, there's policy around that. Staff get evaluated twice a year. They get the performance bonus is calculated on the basis of how well they do in their performance evaluation, and that happens once a year where everybody gets a bonus. And then at the time that we do the cost of living increase, which is now what the kind of current strikes are about, is we then also do a performance-related increase for those people who've done got high scores on their performance evaluation appraisal, get a little bit more than correctly, the big increase in terms of the deputy commissioner's salary was because I don't think that 106,000 reflects the entire year. I think he was only appointed then. That's not to me. It reflects, I mean, I spoke about earlier on that we did these benchmarking exercises for the whole organization and then implemented it in this period. So the increase from 2000, from the previous year to the year under review, does show some increase in salaries as a consequence of that benchmarking exercise. Okay, so that accounts for some of perhaps a greater increase than in the normal course. Now, my salary as the commissioner was not subjected to that benchmark. Well, it was, but I don't decide my own salary. The DG and the minister decide my salary and my bonus. So we have two different agencies deciding mine and the rest of the organization. So you'll find the rest of the organization is pretty consistent if you remove me in terms of how it happens. But my salaries, I'm afraid, I'm at the mercy of the of a political system that I've got to work with. Okay, so yeah.
By yourself.
Well, I mean, that's what the market requires for the staff, and I mean that's something that needs to be brought to the attention of the minister, quite frankly. I mean, he decides my salary. I'm not complaining too much, though.
No, it's human.
But you asked me.
I think the question was asked because you seem to be getting lower than your deputy.
Yeah.
It. I don't know.
Well, the short answer to the question is I decide my deputy's salary and somebody else decides my salary. So, you know, that's...
But what's the principle there?
I'm working off a market-related benchmarking exercise that we did. And I am, quite frankly, you know, there might be a problem with where I'm pitched.
Okay. Let's hear Dr. Huang.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm very surprised of what the commissioner said. He decided his deputy salary, then is over the, his salary. You are humanity, I'm very proud of you. Your deputy is become to your boss. This one is unfair by the label. Because this is government. Government, the label is, your label is up to the your deputy label. How he can bonus get better to you. And you decide that he take more than to your salary. I think this one is totally unfair. Not to say you are the very humankind. No, you are the boss. You are the label 11 or label 5. Your deputy must be the label under your label. How he can get more bonus to you. I think this is totally unfair. Yeah. Also for the bonus stand, I also don't understand what stand from the US side that can make this stand by you are the boss. Yeah. So I think it's my chairperson was the MEC finance. He totally understands for this process. Yeah. Maybe he can give suggestions. Thanks.
On this issue, and
yes.
Because I have
salaries, yes.
Well, on this issue myself, I would really say that we need to get a full, comprehensive, and the information on this, because we are just looking at these figures as they are written here, and we need to understand the gaps and the in totality, so that. Because some of the things are happening right now. If for instance we're looking at what is happening now with the rise of the and of salaries and they were meant to close the gaps and between the higher levels within the civil service and lower at some point. And that's why I'm saying that myself, based on these figures, I don't know what is the overall principle that has been followed in order to arrive to this. It does look absurd. It does look absurd as far as I'm concerned. It's difficult for me to make judgment just based on these figures. We need to get full presentation on the question of salaries and then understand if we want to participate in this debate in the manner in which we are suggesting right now.
I agree. You know, the secretary has gone out. I guess it's taking everything back. I hope the recorder will record this. This is something that you must request the department to come and brief us on. That's why I was asking the principal from Seramboro, because it would seem, I'm looking at the secretary, Mr. Dreyer, the commission secretary, and not long, the secretary will be also overtaking you as a commissioner. So we really don't understand the policy research and so forth. I mean, there has to be an understanding of what's happening in this institution. So maybe we should request the minister and the DG to come and brief us on the salary packages. We are aware, though, that there is a team dealing with the SOE, you know, reconfigurations and all those issues, investigation of the packages and everything. But as it stands now, we want to understand what's happening in the institution itself. The absurdity is that you decide salaries for your lower people. Informed by what? We don't know. Because that is very, very important that we understand, because if you pitch their salaries, because if I look at the deputy commissioner was around 996 in the previous financial year, now at one something.
1291.
You see?
There is an increase in pay.
So one would want to understand how many percent and the bonus levels also, what informs the levels. I understand what you said just now. But it will be important to understand from the principle-based point of view.
And Madam Chair, several servants must remember women's focus targets. There must also be something there for us as members of Parliament as well.
I heard in your report, there's somewhere in your report presentation where you mentioned also that you are still working on averaging your salaries according to the civil service one. You have now done, but it's still there. You've written something to that regard. I just can't say which page is that, but there is somewhere where I come across that. So it's something that we would need full presentation around, so that you can have a clear understanding of what's going on. Can we leave it at that, Commissioner?
It's a very easy thing to explain. Basically, the bottom line here is we were in the organization as a whole was on a salary scale that was even lower than the DPSA bands, because we were seen as kind of independent of, and not, you know, when we started off falling under, we were like SARS. SARS doesn't have the same kind of salary kind of scales as the rest of the civil service.
The reason why I wanted to stop you is because we are awaiting that. The explanation will get it from there.
Yes.
So I want us to have a complete explanation and understanding, and that you can motivate and say all those things when you report to us. Can we leave it at that for the sake of time?
Yes.
So that we don't, you know, because otherwise we're going to be agitated to ask further clarity. We're not going to put you under any difficulty or perhaps appear as though we are we're instigating the minister to do something. No, we're not. We understand the way it was raised. It was not raised by you. We raised it And that is the matter now of the committee, not your matter.
2 points, Chair. A is...
Can I stop you? I am going to stop you on anything related to the salaries now. Thank you. May we continue? There was a follow-up also from Mr. Ngonyama.
No, food and agro-processing, the priorities, and infrastructure and construction. Definitely they are impacting on the welfare of the people, especially when it comes to the food and agro-processing. The other one, it's more on the employment creation, as you said. Has there been any drop with regard to investigation and complaints noticeable within the period concerned, especially with regard to the milling, maybe, so that we see whether we're winning in this regard in curbing and these unwarranted and unnecessary monopolies that are impacting on the people negatively. And because even the infrastructure, if we look at the infrastructure, it would definitely be impacting, it's having a multiplier effect of impacting on the housing, the delivery of houses in the country. If you talk about the price of cement and bricks and stuff like that, and it is within that context that I'm raising this. And because if there is drop of investigations and complaints, then it means that we are somehow winning. That's it.
I think this is a matter that M. Sotis was raising yesterday, I think. I don't know why she not following up on that matter. M. Sotis, you remember we deferred this matter to today's meeting with the Competition Commission. Are you covered by that question? By Mr. Ngonyama? Oh. It is related to the impact. No. The Competition Commission outcome of this penalties. No?
I wonder whether we'll get an increase.
So you okay? Let him respond, and then perhaps the member of this will see, because she was not listening; she was reading.
I don't have all the figures here, but I can reflect the general trend. The trend is we are getting more investigations currently. We're getting more complaints, and the numbers are primarily driven by the sectors that you have mentioned, food and agro-processing, as well as infrastructure and construction. So it's happening now. I think it's going to take some time to see whether these interventions have had the effect of uncovering everything, where you start to see the drop in numbers. Let me make an example. We've spoken about construction. I mean, we've announced it as a priority. We're doing some work. We have a corporate leniency applicant who is bringing in a lot of these contracts to the commission. So it's happening now. Whether they have stopped or not is something that we will see in the next couple of years, I would submit. And it's the same with food and agro-processing. There are certain subsectors where you can say the cleaning up has sort of been almost completed. Milling is one of them. Milling, I don't know if you've been following, but we after a whole round of investigation, we've called upon smaller millers, largely based on in certain regions and provinces. As part of the process of cleaning up, we have offered people settlement terms that we think are favorable. Again, just to encourage that they must uncover the conduct so we know that the cleaning up is complete. So milling, we can say we're not getting any new complaints. We have a number of people we are talking to, settlement, who have come forward and admitted to the conduct. So certain subsectors, yes, we've done a lot of progress, but food and infrastructure.
Are you okay, Mr. Ngonyama?
Well, I am okay, Madam Chair. I'm definitely okay, and with the explanation. Save just to say that maybe it's really a political statement more than, and just to say that this definitely should be an area of focus. Because when we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about housing. We're not going to be able to win this battle on housing if we're having the collusions and the dominance that is reflected. And something extraordinary has to be done to reinforce the process. I'm not sure what is it. Proposals can be brought by the commission. Something extraordinary. We'll have to think also, Madam Chair, as the committee, what is it that we need to do our to clean up this thing, so that it's easy for this and the rollout to actually happen. Again, on the question of food, the level of poverty in South Africa is very, very high, and unnecessarily food is being imported, and they could be produced at a reasonable price inside the country. We have said so much about the Chinese, Madam Chair, in conclusion. We have said so much about the Chinese and their participation in the continent, and in South Africa in particular. But one good thing that has happened about it, it has brought down the prices and of some elements, components within the clothing industry. And,
okay. Thank you. Member Tete, have you thought of? I think the issue was around the impact of the outcome of, for instance, Pioneer. I'll give it as an example. You had said initially that you cannot participate in ensuring that the price gets lowered before. Is there any way, I'll repeat her question yesterday, yesterday's question. Is there any way of ensuring that you work with other stakeholders that are relevant to cutting the price, to ensuring that there are prices, the prices are cut, to take them to the period before the collusion? I think that was your question, ma'am. Am I representing you correctly? Your initial, I think in one of our meetings where we engaged with you, you said the responsibility lies with the consumers themselves and the politicians could assist in that regard. But then we say you have consumer councils, you have all other stakeholders in this regard who can assist in lowering, you know, the prices, especially after the outcome of the verdict in terms of that collusion practices. Can you respond again so that we can, if her mind is is here, she can be able to follow. But why I'm raising this, because I don't want it to come again, so especially in relation to the work that you're doing. Thanks.
Ma'am, you want to come in before she hears?
I'm just adding to that. I think you have covered it appropriately. The other one was that of dumping, you know, in relation to the report that you got from ICHEC, that they only deal with the hazardous goods and others is not the competency. That is goods being expensive in foreign countries, but in the country of origin, cheaper in countries, but more expensive in the country of origin. If there's anything that the Competition Commission could do.
Okay. You may respond.
Look, just to summarize the kind of where we've debated this in the past, is that, I think the point is to be clear that the Competition Commission does not set. We can't say what the price should be. We don't set the price. We create conditions under which people compete, and then in that process, prices will fall, and the system must be self-regulatory. Okay, so that's we don't have a mandate to be setting the price. But I think the question of what our remedies are, and you know, how we, what conditions we place on firms following a prosecution, and whether those are the most effective in creating the kind of level playing field that will be fair and ultimately realize lower prices, is something that we are certainly looking at. In other words, should we be, does the law allow us to place certain additional behavioral constraints on parties to behave in particular ways? It's not setting the price, but it's doing more in order to kind of ensure that the ultimate outcome of lower prices does get achieved. And I think those are issues that we are kind of seriously looking at. You know, and those will be very case specific. You know, we must ask the question, is the fine the only thing we can do here? Are there other things we can be doing in order to, within the law, that don't set the price, but but gives us a better chance that the prices will indeed fall? And I think those are things we kind of, with all the public feedback, particularly from this committee we're getting, it's something we are forced to be thinking about. I think the other question about dumping is, look, this is not quite dumping, but if you look at our cases that involve import parity pricing, you know, import parity pricing, you know, this occurs in like steel, in other kind of, and in a few other markets as well. What happens with import parity pricing is we pay more for a product that we produce than outside people are producing, and that's not dumping. That's not quite dumping. That's a different. That is a competition matter. Dumping we don't deal with. I mean, the commission doesn't deal with dumping. Dumping is where that's not because dumping is something that's happening in somebody else's market, and they must deal with it there.
Or the other authorities.
Yes. Or the other authorities who
But I think the gist of the question is, how then do you collaborate to ensure that you also assist through your knowledge and experience and assist those? Because we're talking cooperative governance. I think that's the essence of her question.
Look, I mean, to be honest, there isn't a concrete example I can give you where we've worked with ITAC on an issue like this. But there's nothing, you know, we are open to kind of making available to them whatever expertise and knowledge we have to assist them. And that's a matter of principle in the general.
And members can initiate also cases, isn't it? So if there's any case that members see that it's really impacting on the competitiveness, you know, within South Africa, we should feel free to also approach the commission. I guess, am I correct? We can do that as individual members of the society. Okay. Just a minute, please. I'm worried about our time for the next meeting also. Yes,
Mr. So a short thing in addition to what Sean has mentioned is what we are doing internally, because we are also very concerned, and we have said before about what happens after our intervention in prices. And so far, what we have identified is which could be a potential problem with prices going down is the extent of information sharing that takes place amongst competitors, particularly facilitated by industry associations. Now, in the, again, focusing on infrastructure and our milling cases, we have told both the baking chamber and the milling chamber that we are investigating the extent to which they could have been used by players in the industry to facilitate collusion, without really talking to each other, by merely submitting that information and that information coming back to them including competitor information. We are investigating that. It's quite a complex investigation. We're doing the same for cement, for example. We have a big information exchange cement and things like fuel, where there's a lot of complexity and a fewer players.
Okay.
We are also, I think, in relation to external stakeholders, I mean, we're talking to the IDC, for example, looking specifically again on the building sector and things like bread to see what can we do to promote.
Okay. Dr. Huang?
No, you can't.
You're okay. Ma'am, you want to come? Is it on the same issue again? The follow up?
Yeah, I think it's just really a comment in relation to our mandate as a competitive association. You know, when I'm listening to the competition commission, it's like what concerned about the outcome of what they are doing. And with us, ultimately, we have to give the output, that's the effectiveness of the outcome, and for us, for as long as it doesn't benefit consumers, because ultimately, they are the ones who put the bill. So that when we don't decide to ultimately, you settle whatever you settle, but how does the taxpayer benefit from consumers?
I think the commission is noting that. Moreover, I had a question, but in the interest of time, I think I'm not going to ask most of them. I had a question on your priority areas, impact on low-income consumers. I just wanted to know what do you mean by this, so that we can understand. Because if you say impact on low-income consumers, it means whatever you are doing should impact positively on the low-income consumers. If you expose a cartel and there's an outcome that is positive, then the consumer must benefit at the end of the day. But if still after exposure and after positive outcome, the consumer still has to fork out a lot of money, then I don't see that having a positive impact on the low-income earners. Yeah, that is one. Secondly, I think it's around accessibility issues. In our oversight visit in Limpopo and Northwest, the issue of Competition Commission accessibility was raised. I don't know whether that was reported back. And I'm hoping that the commission is doing something. In Limpopo, there was a decision, a commitment from the commission that they'll go back within 2 months. We want to know if that has happened. So that you begin to educate and make people aware of the existence of the commission and the roles and responsibilities of the public in relation to your work. I will be failing also if I don't raise issues around that you earlier on complained about, but I don't see anything coming out. Maybe it's going to come in your second quarter report, I'm not sure. It's something that will continue to affect you. Perhaps it's already affecting you. That is the resourcing. You have indicated that you're getting 80 million out of 400 and something. That's what you've indicated already. But I think you also understand that the money is shared among departments, especially according to the priority of the country. But at the same time, we should perhaps as a committee be recommending that the share should also follow, you know, the work that is done. I don't know how successful will that be, because you'll find transport saying we are generating more income, helping in the generation of income, but we get less. And our work is very important because we still have priority issues of making sure that we perfect the transport system of the country and so forth. So this is also within the competition. I mean, the competition within the state itself is something that needs to be looked into. And it's just unfortunate that some of these things cannot overtake the country's priorities. In the interest of time, I'll shelve my questions and take the opportunity to thank you very much for the engagement. I think we always learn something or two from each other whenever we engage. And because the work we are doing is very, very crucial and very important, actually, we will continue to be, you know, putting questions in such a way that sometimes you may feel uncomfortable. But it's meant to help the situation rather than to do anything else. We are here to help each other to govern the country in a proper manner. And besides that, to make a positive impact in the lives of our people. That's the contribution we are all making. And if we take it in that spirit, I think it will help us grow in our work also, individually and as a collective. So thank you very much for this, for the report and the way you presented it and responded. And also thanks to the members for this particular session. We are still going to the next session. Yes, our next meeting is at 2. In the same office.
Chair, I'd also like to thank you and the committee members for the way you've kind of engaged with us and debated with us and for your support generally to us as an institution. And particularly for your kind of understanding and the attention you give to the detail of our work. I think that is something that, you know, we've been to committees in the past where it was people didn't know what we're talking about and didn't engage in the kind of way that this committee does. So thank you very much for that. You talked to us in a very kind of empowering way. And thank you for that.
Thank you. I guess members are listening. And that's also encouraging members to also engage further. Thank you. The meeting stands a chance.
There's no lunch, yeah?